Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. This year, we the people will decide the fate of the nation in our election. We're just 68 days from Election Day, November 3rd, with early voting and mail-in voting happening much sooner. We must dump Trump, who has been a horrendous failure in dealing with the pandemic, the economy, and race relations. We must elect Joe Biden and other Democrats to heal our wounds and get America moving forward again. Our first guest, Kat Calvin, will talk about her proven strategy to get more people to vote as head of her group, Spread the Vote. Following her will be great election analysis with Harold Meyerson, executive editor of the American Prospect magazine. First up is Kat Calvin, the founder and executive director of Spread the Vote and co-founder and CEO of the Project ID Action Fund, a national organization that helps Americans get the IDs they need for jobs, housing, and voting. Kat is a lawyer, activist, and social entrepreneur who attended Mount Holyoke College and the University of Michigan Law School. Kat Calvin, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I heard you on the Kojo and Andy show on Monday, and I was so excited to hear about you and what you're doing. So tell our listeners a little bit about your group, Spread the Vote.
Sure. So Spread the Vote is a nonprofit organization that our core goal is to help people get IDs, primarily in voter ID states. So there are over 21 million eligible voters in the country who don't have the ID they need, and yet there are 36 states in which voter ID laws are on the books, and in certain circumstances, you need them in all 50 states. And so we help folks get all the documents required, pay all the required fees, help with advocacy, pre-COVID help with transportation to the polls. Now we help in other safe ways, but basically do everything we can to help folks get IDs, which they use for jobs, housing, medical care, COVID testing, ironically enough, in a lot of places, but then also to vote. And when it comes around to an election, we do a lot of voter education. 77% of our clients have never voted before, so we do a lot of printed voter guides, helping first-time voters, and then take people to the polls. So that's a big core of our work. And then this year, we've also added a lot of different projects and campaigns to help address the issues that we see are going to either be an issue specific to 2020 or be exacerbated by the circumstances of this year, so that we can do what we anything we can to make sure everyone can vote.
That's fantastic. It's a wonderful idea. And of course, we know that since the Supreme Court decision in 23 undermined the Voting Rights Act, there's been a big move by Republicans to suppress the vote. I mean, they can't win on the issues, so they try to suppress likely Democratic voters from voting. That's, you know, their best shot at winning sometimes. But a lot of the strategy for most people in response to that has been legal, like bringing it to the courts and challenging it and saying, no, we really still do need the protection for voters because of voter suppression, voter intimidation. You took like a very practical, hands-on approach. How did you get the idea about helping people just get the voting ID they need to vote?
Yeah, you know, first I will say this is by far not just a Republican tactic. You know, if you look at Rhode Island and New Hampshire, which are Democratic states, they have very harsh voter ID laws. And it's something that we're seeing people in power, regardless of party, you know, just like we see people who are pro-gerrymandering, they want to prevent new voters from voting, and voter ID laws are a way to do that. You know, for me, I tend to be super practical, and when I start an organization or a project, I need to be able to, at night, know exactly how much I've done and like what my impact has been. You know, law school was great, but I don't have RBG's patience. Like, I can't spend 30 years in litigation waiting to see that change. I need to get an ID right now. And you're right, there are a lot of amazing organizations that have been doing litigation and seeking, you know, both judicial and legislative remedies to voter ID laws forever, particularly since that 2013 SCOTUS decision, Shelby County v. Holder. But the fact is they don't really work. You know, Texas's voter ID law has been struck down 5 times by the court, and we still have it. You know, we've seen, you know, Pennsylvania is really the only state that successfully fought off voter ID laws. It just doesn't work. And so, you know, after the 16 election, I just thought, look, if we have these laws, if we're going to have them, if it seems pretty clear they're not going away, then the best thing to do is just help people get the IDs they need.
Good for you. I love what you're doing. And, you know, most people don't realize how many people don't vote. When we think about 2016, roughly a quarter of the people eligible to vote voted for Trump, about a quarter plus 3 million voted for Hillary Clinton, and almost half the people eligible to vote just didn't vote at all. I mean, and that was in a big election with billions of dollars spent trying to get people to vote. So it's a huge number of people who could vote that don't. And how significant do you think it is, like, in stopping people? Like, how significant is this voter ID restriction for stopping people in your experience?
Well, it's hugely significant. So, you know, 83% of eligible voters in America are registered to vote. But like you said, only 55% turned out in 16, and that was record numbers. 50% turned out in 18, and that was record numbers. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a huge problem, and this is the thing that I'm particularly obsessed with this massive gap between people who are registered and people who don't show up. And a huge reason for that is the barriers. And one of them is voter ID. So if you look at, for instance, Wisconsin, there are over 300,000 registered voters who don't have the ID they actually need to vote. You know, the margin of victory between Clinton and Trump in 16 in Wisconsin, I think, was 17,000 votes. You know, it was a tiny percentage of the people who didn't have the ID. In Virginia, over 200,000 people who are registered to vote don't have the ID they need to vote, right? That is the case of state after state after state. And so, you know, these kinds of voter ID laws, along with, you know, barriers with childcare, incredibly long lines, barriers with languages, you know, just basic voter education, there are a ton of things that stop people who are already registered from actually getting to the polls.
Right. Well, you've identified a huge gap and an immediate urgent need, and you're filling it. So, how many states are you active in this year?
In 12 states.
12 states. And what are some of those states?
Texas, Florida, Wisconsin, Georgia, Virginia, North Carolina. Oh, let's see if I name them all. Tennessee, Michigan, Indiana. And there's three that I'm Louisiana, which my heart goes out to right now. And then there are two more that I'm sure I thought I said and I didn't. But you can go to spreadthevote.org/states and see all 12 states.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And I read an interview with you back in 2018 at the midterms, and you were only in 5 states at the time. So now you're growing and you're in 12 states. So hats off to you for keeping your organization alive and expanding. And a lot of those states, how do you select which states? Because isn't it something like 36 states have some kind of voter ID law?
Yeah, 36 states have voter ID laws. And actually, the ID need is a desperate issue in all 50. So, you know, it's sort of a variety of things. We look a little bit at how strict the voter ID laws are in a place. We look at, you know, what kind of work is being done in a state, who has come and asked us. You know, part of the reason that we actually are in Indiana, first of all, Indiana has some of the most strict voter ID states in the country, which is no surprise because their former governor is now our vice president and he's very pro voter ID. But it gets overlooked a lot. And we had a ton of people reach out to us over an extended period of time and say, please come to Indiana, we really need you. And then the more we looked at it, we said, you know, yeah, definitely we think we need to be here. So partially it's, you know, how much are we hearing from folks that this is a place where there's an issue? You know, and then partially it's looking at, you know, where are there so many barriers to voting? You know, Texas, it's so hard to vote in Texas. It's really hard to register voters in Texas. You can't vote absentee if you're under 65. There's so many barriers that we knew that going there and helping get IDs would help be a big part of helping to alleviate that. And then we help our clients then with every step of the process, we can help them get around all of those other barriers too. You know, so we look at a lot of issues. And at the end of the day, you know, There's so many states I want to be in and I can't wait to be in, and it's a budgetary thing. So it's also looking at, can I afford to launch? And, you know, we may be in the greatest depression next year. I may not be able to launch any more states. So a lot of it too is just looking at what we have the funding for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. Well, we got to get you some more resources. If some of our listeners want to support what you're doing, how do they send you some money?
Yeah, that would be amazing. And you can go to spreadthevote.org/donate.
Fantastic. And listeners, I think this is some of the biggest bang for your buck you're going to get in this year, because you can give to Joe Biden, and I hope you do, but you know, he's going to raise probably $1 billion. So our small donations aren't going to make much of a splash there, but you could help Kat Calvin here spread the vote, whatever you can send over to her to help enroll some more people. Cause you know, sometimes my understanding, Kat, and you can tell us a little more, like how you help someone, but sometimes say they lack $31 to pay the voter ID fee. And so you actually pay that $31 and make sure they get the ID, right?
We do. Yep. Our average ID cost is $40. We help pay for the birth certificates. The biggest costs are birth certificates and the IDs themselves. Sometimes we have to, you know, oh my gosh, when we're looking for records, you know, we have to order things sometimes from hospitals or school records or departments of corrections, et cetera. But our average cost is $40. And yeah, I mean, if you think about it, if you don't have an ID, you can't get a job. So the vast majority of the people we work with are unemployed or underemployed. And so, you know, $40, look, I work for a nonprofit. $40 is a lot of money for me, but it's a lot of money for our clients. And so I, you know, without that, they can't get it. And we work with folks who sometimes haven't had ID for 10, 20, 30 years because of all the barriers. And so we do everything we can to help them get around those.
Yeah. So, you know, if we donate just $40, we could get another voter in there. And, you know, this is nothing more American than voting. However people decide to cast their vote, the vote is sacred. We got to get people voting and get those 45% who aren't voting to the polls to have their voice be heard. You know, voting is free power. I'm amazed that people give away free power, but sometimes it is. They don't have that $40 to get the ID. So you're helping them with that. So can you tell us the story of, say, one person that really strikes out for you, like a case study that illustrates what your group does and how you work?
Yeah, there's so many great stories. We worked with an incredible young woman in Virginia who she was 17 when we met her, and she was in a youth shelter. And she was turning 18 before the election. But one thing we find frequently that we found with her is when we have folks who need an ID because they need a steady place to live or a job or whatever, when we try to talk to them about voting, they're like, well, I can't think about voting. I don't know where I'm, you know, going to sleep tonight. And so our volunteer worked with her, helped her get her ID, you know, and then when she got in her hands, you know, then when we talk to people about voting, then they're, you know, one common thing that we hear from folks when they get an ID is they say, I'm a person again. And if you think about it, you can't think about exercising that free
power
if you're not actually a person, which you're not in this country without an ID. And so after we got her this ID and she got into a better place than the youth shelter she was in, and our volunteer, you know, kept in touch. We worked really hard to make sure we stay in touch with our clients and talked to her and said, hey, so there's this election coming up. I know I told you about it before. Can we talk about it? And she said, yeah, you know what? I think I do want to vote. And she turned 18 and we registered her to vote. And then that same volunteer picked her up on election day, took her to the polls. She voted. She sent a picture with a huge smile and a sticker. Then she took her out for a celebratory pizza lunch. And now she's a voter. And, you know, I think that is, it's such a perfect illustration of the fact that, you know, we so often are so focused on just the thing we want from people, which is we just want you to vote. And we forget that people have so many things going on in their lives and so many challenges, and that we have to really look at them for what they need and what's going to make them feel safe and powerful and like they can make those choices. And then when we do that, we see over and over again that then when we talk to our clients, they can't wait to vote.
That's fantastic. So how do you make sure they vote? Like once they get the ID, what do you register them to vote at the same time they get the ID, that kind of thing? And then does someone take them to the polls or check in on them? Or how do you know it actually leads to a vote?
Yeah, well, on the back end, we do an annual survey every year of all of our clients. So we know exactly how many have voted. But on the front end, so we register 91% of our eligible clients. We do work with some different departments of corrections, jails, different things. So we do help people get IDs sometimes who aren't eligible to vote. But about 80% of our clients are eligible to vote, and we registered 91% of those. And then we do a lot of education work. So I don't know if I mentioned, but 77% of our clients have never voted before. And so we have to do a lot of, you know, voting 101. So we print our own guides. Everything we do has to be sort of printed and in person, because only 1% of our clients have regular access to a phone. Almost none of them have access to the internet. So everything we do is, you know, paper. So we print and publish our voter guides that we make very sort of simple 101, how to vote, why to vote, what these offices even are, you know, and they're totally nonpartisan. And we just try to break down everything in simple language. Mm-hmm. And then we have voting parties, which traditionally we do in person. This year, we're working with our on-the-ground partners and doing this sort of hybrid virtual-ish model. But where our volunteers, who we train, then, you know, walk our clients through the guides. And they spend a good 2 months getting in touch with all of our clients, finding, you know, we do a lot of work staying on the ground regularly with partners and in the communities in the areas where we meet our clients, so that we're constantly in touch with them, which is great, because then we get updates about when they get a job or when they get housing or all sorts of things. And then we invite them and their friends and family to voter parties, and they have, you know, food and cake and music for the kids and all sorts of things. And we walk everyone through the voter guides and make sure they understand how they're voting, what they want to vote for. You know, they circle the candidates and the ballot measures, whatever, and they make a voting plan. And then usually what we do is that we either do these parties during early voting in the states where we have that and just walk them over to the polls, or they say, okay, your volunteer, you know, Mary is going to pick you up at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, and they know to expect someone, and then we drive them to the polls. This year, we're working on COVID-safe transportation and making sure that we can still help folks get to the polls, but doing it in a safer way. But, you know, yeah, it's very hands-on every step of the way, which is tough and it takes a long time. But for folks who have never voted before and who have never been part of this process, if you don't do it hands on every step of the way, they're just not going to get to the vote.
And I love how you work, where it's not just, you know, you don't come in after Labor Day and with a big rush going, we need you to register and vote for our person. It's not that. It's about, hey, you know, this is something that could be helpful to you to get this government issued ID. We can help you do that. That helps you with your life, would help you with a lot of things, and that you stay in regular contact. I mean, and this is the complaint I've heard frequently from marginal voters who they know they're just being used by politicians who want them to vote in this election, as opposed to your approach is you're actually helping your client, and then voting is just one of many things that helping them get that ID helps them do.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a huge part of, I mean, I hate to see our model because it sounds more strategic than it was, but really for us, you know, our volunteers all live and work in the communities that they serve. They, you know, we've got volunteers who have been going to the same shelter every Tuesday for 2 or 3 years now. You know, they're known, the clients know them, they bring their friends. You know, I love when I go visit because everybody knows everybody. And I've been to many of our partners multiple times, you know, around the country. And they just, and they're trusted and they know, you know, Alice got me an ID and she helped me. And so not only do they encourage other people to trust them, but when Alice then is like, hey, let's talk about voting, they know her, they trust her, they see her every single week, you know? And so they know that she really cares, and they know that, you know, we've already gone out of our way to help them get the thing that they needed to change their lives. And so that we're not just there to use them, and we're not just there. And, you know, for a lot of the folks we work with, no one ever talks to them about voting. You know, candidates don't go to homeless shelters, right? They don't go to rehab centers. They don't go to a lot of these places. And so, excuse me, no one is talking to them at all. And we try to get local candidates to come out to some of our voting parties, and it's very difficult to get them to care. We actually just launched a 501c4 in which we're going to endorse candidates who do care and make this an issue people care about, and work to pass legislation for the millions of people who don't have IDs, because it's, you know, this is a group of folks who get totally ignored, you know, on either side of the aisle. When people are canvassing or calling voters, they're calling people, you know, in van or whatever equivalent system that have voted before, you know, which are mostly, you know, white middle class. They're not calling and reaching out to people who've never voted before, people who are, you know, under the radar, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so for us, you know, because we're part of those communities, because we're there and we're known, it really helps, because when we talk to people about voting, they know us and they know they can trust us and they know we care.
That is so awesome. I love that. You're really building a relationship and supporting the person, not just like exploiting them for this vote, this election. So important. How do you find your clients? Like, how do you figure out who needs this kind of help?
Yeah. So I, you know, one of the things about the way this country is segregated economically is that you're usually either in a room with everybody having, you know, where everyone has an ID, or in a room where almost no one does. And so It's not, you know, we partner on the ground with the same groups of folks who serve the 11% of the population who don't have ID, who I do. Shelters, food banks, churches, prisons, schools, et cetera. And then, you know, work in partnership with those on the ground partners. Now, at this point, we're well known enough in these communities that we get a lot of people who, you know, will call or reach out to us individually. We work with a ton of state agencies now and departments of corrections and places that know us. And so they reach out to us. But our core sort of way that we started and the way that we really work is that we go to where the largest groups of people are who don't have ID. You know, if you don't have ID and you can't work and you can't get housing, et cetera, then you are usually in some sort of contact with some sort of service agency. You often are experiencing homelessness or are returning citizen or are in a program with a social worker. We work with a lot of social workers and caseworkers. You know, we partner with the New Orleans Public Defender's Office. So we don't have offices because we're always just on the street and in the rooms with wherever the folks are who need IDs.
Fantastic. That's really great. And, you know, there's a lot of concern this year about the new twist on voter suppression is a massive effort to discredit the election and to gum up the works on the vote by mail, which a lot of us are going to want to do because of the pandemic. We're nervous about getting with a group and catching the virus. And so a lot of us want to vote by mail, but then we've got the Trump administration and his postmaster general there kind of deliberately slowing it down and smashing machines that process mail quickly. So what's your message to people who want to vote by mail, but they're nervous about the problems that Trump has created in the post office?
Act proactively. You know, the great thing is that we know these things are happening so we can work on solutions. So first, if you have not requested your absentee ballot, do so now. Like literally while you're listening to this, Google your Board of Elections, request your absentee ballot as early as possible. And then when you get it in, you have three different options to turn in your ballot. So one is you can mail it through the post office, which if you're going to, the day you get your ballot, fill it out and mail it in. You want to mail it back as soon as possible. However, in many states, there are, and I believe it's 20 states plus DC, but don't hold me to that. Go to your Board of Elections website. They put out ballot boxes where you can drop your ballot and then the Board of Elections picks it up. So it doesn't have to go through USPS. So I really recommend that. And in nearly every state, you can actually drop off your ballot at the polling place. In fact, a lot of polling places will even have a table outside with a poll worker and a little box, and you can drop it off there. And so I really recommend dropping your ballot off at a polling place or in a ballot box before you mail it. And I know for sure is 20 states plus DC, which means the ballot box number was wrong. Third parties can pick up ballots for you. So if you're, not high risk for COVID, then you can go around and pick up, your grandparents' ballot or your neighbors or your friends or whatever and drop them all off. And if you are, then you can find someone to drop your ballot off for you. So see in your state, you can go on your Board of Elections website to find this out. We'll be doing a big virtual campaign at the end of September to give everybody as much information as they need about getting their ballot accurately filled out and turned in. Figure out in your state, do we have ballot boxes? Can I drop it off at my polling place? And aim for those first before you take it to USPS.
That's such great advice, you know, and I hope, you know, listeners, you're really paying attention. That's very important, what Kat just said there. Vote early. You know, get your ballot as the day you request it early, if you need to request it. As the day you get the ballot, fill it in and either mail it back immediately or put it in a Dropbox if the Board of Elections provides one, which many states do. So you don't want to delay it all and end up being, you know, one of the votes that may not be counted because it gets stuck in the post office somewhere. Just do it early. Mail is getting delivered. It's just in some places getting slowed down. So vote early. And Kat, for people who want to stay in touch with what you're doing, you've got a Vote the Podcast, right? You want to tell us about Vote the Podcast?
I do. So the CEO of Vote.org, Andrea Haley, and I have a podcast called Vote the Podcast. It comes out every Thursday. You can get it on literally every podcast platform. It's on podcast platforms I didn't know existed. We've been interviewing awesome people like Stacey Abrams and Mark Elias, who is the voting rights attorney to the stars, and Bradley Whitford. We talk about, you know, this week we have Ross Morales-Vaquetto, who is the co-founder of Run for Something, which is an amazing organization. We're talking all about local elections, which is an obsession of mine. And then we try to give folks tips for what they can do. In the next few weeks, we're moving to a more urgent format where we are going to tell you, these are the laws that are changing right now. This is what you need to be aware of in your state. We're going to answer some questions that we're getting in and make sure that as we get to these final weeks leading up to the election, that people just have quick information about exactly what they need to know to vote. So Vote the Podcast. Yeah, please listen and subscribe. We think it's a good time. We have fun making it. I hope people are having fun listening to it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I want to listen to that one. Congratulations on scoring Bradley Whitford. I loved him in West Wing. So I'm definitely going to check out that podcast.
A lot like Josh Lyman in real life, too. It's pretty funny.
I'm happy to hear that. We just have about a minute left here, but can you talk a little bit about the importance of local elections when it comes to voting rights?
Oh my gosh. I mean, so on two sides, first of all, if you want to suppress votes, then it's much easier to do so in elections that have smaller margins of victories, like local state elections. And I count House of Representatives elections as local elections because they really are, and they usually are elected by small margins. And so, you know, but local elections, and one thing I think that has been good about COVID and about the BLM protests is that people are really starting to understand that your local representatives really can be the difference between life and death. About 75 to 80% of the decisions that affect your life directly are made by local and state governments. So we ignore them, we all focus on the Iron Throne, but who your board of supervisors is, who your county commissioner is, who your mayor, your sheriff, your DA is, those people make the decisions that run your life. And so there is nothing more important than, first of all, voting in every local election, supporting the candidates who you think are really going to make a difference, who align with your values, and think about running for local office as well. It's so important that we have great people at all levels.
That's great. Well, I hope you decide to run it sometime.
I don't think I have the patience for that.
Your work is too important right now. We need you in the field. So I'm so happy you're doing what you're doing. And so once again, listeners, this is Kat Calvin with Spread the Vote. And give us your website, Kat.
Spreadthevote.org.
Spreadthevote.org. That's all the time we have, Kat Calvin. Thank you so much for being with us today and for helping democracy defeat disenfranchisement.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good luck.
Thanks. Bye.
Listeners, stay tuned for our next guest.
PRN. Progressive Radio Network.
Harold Morrison is one of the nation's leading political analysts. He's editor at large of the American Prospect, one of the top political magazines in the country. He has also been a weekly op-ed columnist for the Washington Post and executive editor of the LA Weekly, the nation's largest metropolitan weekly. He's here with us today to share his analysis of the 2020 election. Harold Morrison, welcome back to All Together Now.
It's always good to be here, Eleanor.
That's great. I appreciate your brilliant analysis and humor, which we've needed a lot of the past 3 years. So I want to start off by looking, the election is just 89 days away. How do we beat Trump?
Well, right now, every poll shows that Joe Biden is beating Trump. That's the result of pretty much universal opposition to Trump by Democrats. And it is the result of the vast majority of the Democrats who supported Bernie Sanders also deciding that they're going to vote for Joe Biden. And it is the result of a weakening in some key constituencies that supported Trump in 2016, notably seniors, voters over 65, who have been are particularly endangered by COVID-19, by the pandemic. And I think that's one reason why Biden has opened a wide lead in Florida, which is the retirement mecca for seniors living east of the Mississippi. And it's, as well, he's not doing nearly as well among white working class women who supported Trump substantially over Hillary Clinton in 2016, but have been alienated by Trump's, just endemic callousness and lack of empathy. So those are two really key constituencies where he is much weaker than he was in 2016. Now, that said, Trump is doing his damnedest to create sort of a dysfunctional election, appropriately enough for a dysfunctional president. He has pretty much ordered the post office to slow down at a time when voter registration and voting by mail will be crucial to the election. And he clearly just wants to call into question the results of the election, which is one reason why the victory by Biden, and I suspect the Democratic takeover of the Senate as well as holding the House, needs to be by a fairly large margin, so that the networks and others going by their exit polling will call the election earlier than all the votes having been counted, since, as we now know, counting ballots by mail can take a very long time.
Right. And in that time, if it comes down to who's voting by mail, there could be a lot of mischief.
Yes. Yes. Well, again, the politicization of the by putting a Trump person atop the Postal Service is, I think, one of the most crucial problems. And congressional Democrats have been calling attention to this now, particularly just in the last few days, as mail delivery across the board slows.
Right, exactly. So where do you see the key battleground states for Biden? And I would imagine some of those overlap with some of the states the Democrats need to win to try and get back the majority in the Senate.
That's true. Well, you begin with the mistakenly called blue wall states of the industrial or post-industrial Midwest. You begin with Pennsylvania, with Michigan, and with Wisconsin. Now, polling has shown that Michigan is, at this juncture, heavily inclined to favor Joe Biden. Hillary Clinton didn't really invest in a voter turnout operation in some of the cities of those states that Democrats need to get a high turnout in to win. Certainly not Detroit, certainly not Milwaukee, and not even Philadelphia. That's a mistake which is not being repeated this time around. So that's a beginning. Secondly, the Republicans before we leave the industrial Midwest, It's also really significant to know that Biden has now, in several in recent polls, taken the lead in Ohio, which is a state Democrats had pretty much written off. Ohio, of all the major states in the United States, has the highest percentage of white working class residents and white working class voters, presumably Trump's base. But as Sherrod Brown, the progressive Democrat who keeps being elected and reelected to the US Senate from Ohio, has demonstrated, there are ways that Democrats still can win Ohio. And Joe Biden seems at the moment to be doing that, I think largely due to the defection of white working class women from Trump's standard. You know, there was a story just came out yesterday that Biden is doing a massive media buy in 15 states. That reflects, I think, both the caution and the optimism of the Biden campaign, that states that Democrats might have written off just 6 months ago, like Ohio, are actually now very much in play. I've already mentioned Florida, but the fact is that, you know, the Republicans since Ronald Reagan have had basically a Sunbelt coalition, that their base has been based in the Sunbelt, where, you know, white racism was strongest. And unionization, the one way that the white working class voters can come into contact with progressive information, unionization was weakest. The Sun Belt is beginning to crack. Arizona, which also has a key Senate race with Mark Kelly, former astronaut, running against Republican Kristen Sinema. Arizona is a state that now looks like it could well be in the Democratic column, both for the Senate and for the presidency. And like most of the Sun Belt, a lot of that is simply due to demographic transformation, the increasing share of the state that is Latino, the increasing share of the electorate that is Latino, and the fact that its cities, like all cities, now are home to liberal whites. Phoenix has had a Democratic mayor now for a long time and has been opposed to most of the Republican state government actions, particularly on immigration. Mm-hmm. So you have that's also the possibility of a transformation down the line in Texas. Texas is sort of in play this year, and that's kind of remarkable, because if Texas is in play, that's like the Republicans putting California in play. I mean, this is the ultimate anchor of the Republican Electoral College base. But the second anchor is Florida, and that severely weakens them. Then again, demographic transformation in Georgia has certainly put Georgia in play, and to a certain degree, North Carolina. And again, as well, the coming of white millennials to the major cities in those states, to Atlanta, to Charlotte, puts those states into play. Now, you know, I mean, I think some people looking at the sort of mega politics thought, well, maybe the Republicans are going to get weaker in the Sun Belt, but maybe the Republicans, due to high white working class populations, can establish a base in the industrial Midwest. But this year, they can't establish that base in the industrial Midwest, and more of the Sun Belt is in play. Now, if you look at states where the Democrats also have possibilities of Senate takeovers, I've mentioned Arizona. The closest parallel to Arizona would be Colorado, where a unpopular Republican senator, Cory Gardner, is not favored to hold his seat. The Democrats are running John Hickenlooper, who was both the mayor of Denver and then the governor of the state. And Hickenlooper stands a good chance of winning. And again, in Colorado, there's been a lot of the two developments that I've been talking about, Latino in migration and the flocking of white liberal millennials to Denver in particular, also Boulder. That's the kind of thing that can change a state. And then if you look at the map, the whole Southwest, you know, including the Pacific Coast, with the exception of heavily Mormon Utah, looks like it's going to become, I think, reliably Democratic in future elections, and I think quite possibly in this election as well. That's a major change. That was a major element of the Republican Sunbelt strategy. Other states, well, I already mentioned North Carolina, where the Republican Senator is Tom Tillis is being opposed by Democrat Cal Cunningham, and Cunningham has a clear lead in North Carolina. So North Carolina is a key swing state, both at the presidential and senatorial level. And then we go up to our northeast corner, Maine, where Susan Collins has been walking a tightrope for much of her career as a self-advertised moderate Republican. But moderate Republican is something of an oxymoron, or becoming more of one with each passing day. And her votes for both of Trump's Supreme Court nominees really sort of stand against her commitment to being pro-choice, of putting these solidly anti-choice judges onto the Supreme Court. And so she's very embattled, and Speaker of the Maine State Assembly, whose name eludes me at the moment, but
Sarah Gideon,
that's right. Yes, thank you. Is the Democratic nominee there, and also has a lead, though not a large lead, over Collins. So Maine, I think, is pretty much in the Democratic column on the presidential line, and it's certainly a state where the Democrats hope to pick up a seat in the Senate. Now that would be that would be four seats, which would be enough to give them a majority, even if Doug Jones loses in Alabama, which is not a given. Doug Jones was kind of a fluke election over Roy Moore, a candidate who clearly liked to spend some intimate time with girls, not women, girls. Because otherwise Alabama would almost never have elected a Democrat. Still, Doug Moore has some real cred there. He's being opposed by the former football coach at Auburn, Tommy Tuberville, which sounds like a name out of a little kid's book. You know, he has a shot. But even if he loses, the Democrats would still have 50 votes. And if Biden is elected, whoever his vice president is, which is an interesting topic in and of itself, would be able to cast a tie-breaking vote. But Democrats are also in the running in some other states. In Iowa is one, and even Mitch McConnell in Kentucky is under the gun and is in a particular conundrum right now, given his opposition to extending unemployment insurance in a state that has lots and lots of poor people who more or less are accustomed to voting for for Republicans, but you know, have been known to deviate from that. Amy McGrath is his opponent there, the Democrat, a former Air Force fighter pilot. So there are a bunch of Republican Senate seats that are still up for grabs. And we should also go to Montana and note that the popular Democratic governor, Steve Bullock, is challenging the Republican incumbent, Mr. Daines. That's a race that's polling pretty close as well. So there are a number of possible Democratic Senate pickups, and I think probably enough for them to take the Senate. And I think clearly they're going to pick up some House seats too. This may turn out to be a wave election in the best of all possible Democratic worlds. And in a wave election, there will be some surprising Democratic victories too. So we'll just have to see.
Right, and I'm hoping we can put Senator Lindsey Graham in that wave and be carried out of office. I don't know, yes. You have any chance to beat Lindsey Graham in South Carolina?
Yeah, I think so. The polling has been surprisingly okay for his Democratic challenger, whose name also eludes me, but you have it right in front of you, don't you?
No.
Jamie Harrison.
Yeah, very good.
Jamie Harrison. Yeah. Okay. Give me a senior moment and a half here. That would be a surprising result, since South Carolina is certainly a bedrock right-wing state. But Trump's weakening, and the fact that Lindsey Graham has been very volubly all over the map in support of Trump, and then now and then, you know, a burst of opposition, and then going back to support, that act may be past its prime in the minds of many South Carolinians. So we shall see. But there, and that too reflects, as does Georgia, as does Florida, as do Texas and Arizona, and North Carolina, the growing peril to the Republican Sunbelt base.
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot of hot elections there, a lot of good possibilities for Democrats. Just want to ask you briefly about women. I know the last time you were on the show, we were talking about the great gains women made in running and winning in 2018. Is that continuing this year? Do we have a lot of good women candidates, or was that a one and done?
Well, there are a lot of good women candidates. It's Sarah Gideon in Maine and in Iowa. The Democrats have a strong woman candidate running against Joni Ernst, another first-term Republican senator whose polling does not show her with anything like a major lead. I think that race was within 1% in the most recent poll, a Monmouth poll that I have seen out of Iowa. Of course, there are interesting Democratic women winning Democratic primaries. Just Tuesday, the surprise victory of Cori Bush in St. Louis, ousting Lacey Clay, who, despite the word Lacey, was male, is evidence of that. And then, of course, as I alluded to a moment ago, we have the whole vice presidential contest in which at this juncture the three front runners are all African American women, plus which in one of the races Cori Bush is not the only progressive woman Democrat to have ousted a Democratic incumbent. Also, what was her name, Newman in Chicago ousted Dan Lipinski in a primary earlier this year. So I think there is a cohort of younger progressive women and younger progressive African Americans who are some of whom will be enlarging the squad, the AOC Gang of Four, in the next Congress.
All right, it's encouraging to see some of the fresh voices coming along. Let's talk about the vice presidential race. I know you wrote a great piece yesterday talking about Karen Bass, who's ahead of the Congressional Black Caucus and longstanding progressive activist and leader in California, that a lot of progressives are hoping that Biden will pick her as kind of a progressive balance on the ticket. What do you see happening? Do you favor Karen Bass, and who do you think Biden will select?
Well, there are two progressives really in the hunt. Karen Bass is one, and Elizabeth Warren is the other. Elizabeth Warren, of course, is not African American, at this juncture, that may be an obstacle. Both Bass and Warren have strong points in being able to help Biden, with getting progressives either more involved in the campaign or actually willing to vote for him if they weren't otherwise. Karen in particular, I think, who is not well known nationally, but I think would be able to bring out sort of a younger Blacks otherwise resistant perhaps to voting for Biden. They each have downsides electorally. Clearly, they provide Republicans with a line of attack, however spurious or semi-real that line of attack may be, because of their clearly liberal politics. Susan Rice, former National Security Advisor under President Obama, and Kamala Harris, Senator from California, are the other two possibilities still very much in the hunt. Rice is a bit of a conundrum. At a time when domestic issues, racial and economic justice, dominate the political sensibility of the Democratic Party and the political discussion in the whole nation, that's really not where she's been and not where she has a record. She's a foreign policy maven and was close to Biden and has a lot of people who worked with her in the Obama administration backing her. The Republicans will no doubt think she said about their trumped up
issue. Talking about who the vice presidential candidate might be that Biden would select. So just to carry on in some of the discussion we're having, some of the other issues to consider in this election is what the average citizen can do to impact this election. And we'll be talking about that more next week. But I think sometimes people have the misconception that the candidate and the campaign staff is the only ones who really get the real work done. And the volunteers are kind of flotsam and jetsam. That could not be further from the truth. Citizens being engaged is probably the single most influential factor here. So you were talking about the vice presidential candidates, and I agree with you. I think it's very odd that Susan Rice has risen to the top of the pack in consideration, given that her only calling card is foreign policy expertise, and A, domestic issues are so important right now, and B, Biden himself has foreign policy credentials and doesn't really need that in a running mate. So, I know they have a personal connection and have worked together when Susan Rice was in the Obama administration, but it just still seems to me kind of an odd choice. And she's not really known in the country. I don't think she'd be a very big draw to help the ticket win. So that kind of baffles me.
Yeah. A number of these candidates, often vice presidential candidates aren't very well known in the country. I mean, who knew Mike Pence? How many Americans knew Tim Kaine, who people have forgotten was Hillary Clinton's vice presidential running mate? But, there was a certain logic to those picks, a certain political logic. I don't see any political logic to picking Susan Rice. She adds nothing to the ticket politically. And as you just pointed out, in terms of Biden's own, fields of specialization, she doesn't add anything, I think, substantively either. It's mm-hmm. It's just that, she signals that, you know, she's someone he can work with. And it kind of also is a backward looking affirmation mm-hmm. of the Obama administration, which I don't think is a necessary virtue either at this juncture. I mean, Biden himself is that. So again, I really don't see what she adds to the ticket.
I agree with you on that. It's looking like it's probably going to be Kamala Harris, but who knows? I mean, anything could happen in the next week or two before Biden makes his selection. So,
well, I agree that Kamala is probably still to be favored. That, though, creates an interesting situation, because if that ticket wins, that creates a vacant Senate seat in California. And Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, gets to appoint a successor. And I think Karen Bass has inadvertently been positioned to be that successor. And I think she would be a great senator.
That's encouraging. Well, I'm sure if we can elect Biden, he'll put some of these wonderful vice presidential candidates in his administration somewhere. So the key is we got to get Trump out and get Biden in, and then we can sort out all the where all the chess pieces go.
Right. Right.
So our last election was impacted negatively by voter suppression, and it did affect the outcome in some key races, like the governor race with Stacey Abrams running for governor in Georgia, and also Andrew Gilliam running for governor in Florida. It was pretty clear voter suppression made the both of them not win the governorships they should have won. How bad is voter suppression in this election, and what can we do to stop it?
Well, the there's no question that their voter suppression is a key element of Republican strategy generally, and every effort will be made to do it. Now, I mean, I think Trump's Trumpization of the post office mm-hmm. is particularly may be their lead form of voter suppression. But again, I think the key is in a state like Florida, and in Florida, of course, voters overwhelmingly passed an initiative allowing former felons to vote, and the Republicans in state government have been doing everything to keep that from happening, of questionable legality, but they have been doing that, almost reinstating a poll tax for former felons. So that's an issue in Florida, but I think the key is just to work to build such a large majority that even these efforts will not have the impact that they did in 2018. I think one of the tricky things is voter registration has become much more difficult in the absence of being able to personally contact people at their doorstep or at the supermarkets or what have you. But working the political universe every way progressives can, by social media, by phone, and where possible in person, I think the key is just building on Biden's lead in various states and making sure that that lead is enlarged, which would thwart the Republicans' voter suppression efforts.
Right. Good advice. And a number of Democrats have criticized Biden for being almost invisible. It's like after he won the primaries in the spring, he didn't quite disappear, but Trump is such a domineering force in the country and politics and the media, and you hardly ever seem to hear from Biden. Now, there is a line of thought that when the opponent is setting themselves afire in flames, don't get in the way, let them do it. So do you think this is a deliberate strategy, or do you think Biden should get out there and be more visible to the American people?
Well, I think the fact that he's just made a $280 million ad buy in 15 states suggests that he is going to be very visible. At this juncture, Trump's ongoing presence isn't helping Trump. I don't think it's a problem on a comparative basis. On sort of an absolute basis, should Biden be more visible? Yeah, he should. But, if I was running the Trump campaign, I would try to keep my guy under wraps, which is impossible. The real problem for the Republicans is Trump's visibility, and even worse, his audibility. If he just shut up, he'd probably gain a couple points in the polls.
Right. Great. Well, we're at our time. That's all the time we have right now. But if people want to learn more about you and your writing, they should go to prospect.org. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah, excellent journalism, excellent writing.
Thank you. Not just me, but our whole staff. We have a great piece online today on Cori Bush's victory in Missouri by one of our wunderkinder, Alex Salmon. So www.prospect.org.
Great. I encourage our listeners to go to that website. Thank you so much for being with us today. And thanks again for your wonderful analysis. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Eleanor. You take care.